I'm Lizzie Pickering. I'm a filmmaker and grief investigator. Having worked in the children's hospice world for many years following the death of my son Harry 20 years ago, I've had the privilege of walking alongside many people who've suffered different forms of loss and find it fascinating learning how people move towards their new normal. Today, I'm chatting to my dear friend Nick Parker about how he is coping with this new landscape in light of coronavirus and why he's made the decision to self-isolate away from his beloved wife and three boys. Nick, can you tell me a bit about this decision in relation to your cancer diagnosis 5 years ago? Can you give us an overview of your health and why you made this decision?
So 5 years ago, after a few pains, aches and pains, which I was ignoring as a typical man sticking his head in the ground, after several months of toing and froing with the doctors, I was diagnosed, unfortunately, with stage 4 advanced aggressive metastasized prostate cancer. And I decided, having been told by the doctors that I was to have palliative care because it was terminal, and when I asked them, why did I get it? They said, you're just unlucky. You've just got duff genes. I decided then to go on a journey of with full respect of what the conventional establishment said, but I decided in them saying I was just unlucky, it just removed hope from my future life. So I decided to take lots of things into my own hands. So this last 5 years has been really a long, long journey, fascinating journey, one that I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed, of looking into all aspects of my life and turning all aspects of my life upside down and relearning them. And then, of course, Corona comes along, and I actually decided that before officially, I've got about 4 underlying health conditions, and before the government said that those who are in a state of health like me should go into stringent lockdown, I decided that I was going to self-impose and go into self-isolation because my children had just come back from university. And I could see a lot of anxiety with them because they were worried that they may bring the virus into the house and they would not want to feel the guilt of giving me something which might challenge my health further. And I could see that I was the problem. And this was before, as I say, the sort of imposed isolation. So I managed to ask around, and some very, very generous friends said, we have a cottage down a very, very long track, and you can use that cottage scot-free, enjoy yourself, and do the things that you need to do. So here I am.
I know that in your cancer journey, you have been on retreats over the years. You've used retreats as a way of dealing with your health challenges, mentally and physically. What have you learned, and what's the difference between this choice of isolation away from your family? Because I know they've been incredibly supportive to you throughout all of this, as have your friends. So this choice to go away entirely on your own, did that feel very different walking into this cottage?
I have to say I entered this very naively. I thought that because I had done 10-day silent retreats, Vipassana retreats, and I've done several of them and got a lot out of them, I thought that I was well prepared for this because 10 days of silence is pretty challenging. But then when I went into self-isolation, I found the first 24 hours here very, very challenging. And I reflected back on my Vipassana retreats and this experience. And it's just the flip side. It's the reverse side. So Vipassana is about a lot of physical proximity, but no talking within lots of people being around, whereas this is no human interaction, but perhaps using a lot of virtual technologies to stay in touch with people. So it's completely the other way around. And I really struggled with that for the first 24 hours. And it's a fascinating other journey that I actually walked into not really knowing what I thought I was well prepared, but I really wasn't. And the first 24 hours definitely caught me out.
How did you get beyond that? How did you move through it? What were your processes? Because they may well help other people who are in isolation through coronavirus.
I think for me that there's two things in my journey that I really, really reflect on, which I have not been good at as a typical male in my previous life. The first thing is about talking. And I would say talking therapy could be formalized by going to see a psychotherapist, or it could be informal, which is just to talk to people. It doesn't matter who it is. Talk to people and pick up the phone and or all those amazing platforms that are around at the moment. So the first thing was to talk about things. And the second thing is to talk from a position of real vulnerability. I'm really intrigued by this word vulnerability. And I think, Lizzie, from what I, you know, you are an amazing person and your story is awesome. And if we address vulnerability and if we're open about vulnerability, how we feel about things, which is particularly difficult for a man, and I think particularly difficult for men who are high up in business and they are meant to be sort of very bold leaders who are to not display signs of weakness. This vulnerability thing is, for me, is a new discovery. And the discovery of being how you're actually, you're more human and more alive and more empathetic and make much greater connections with other humans by admitting that you are vulnerable, feeling vulnerable.
Absolutely. And Brené Brown talks about links between vulnerability and courage. And I see that so massively. I do quite a lot of work with companies and grief and change in the workplace. And very recently, I was with somebody who was management at a very, very big global company. They were known as somebody who was made of steel. It wasn't until I sat with them in a meeting one-to-one and they broke down. And I saw more courage in that moment of them breaking down about how they really felt about certain issues than I'd seen in all the behavior around the steely input and the wall. I just find it fascinating. And, you know, I suppose I know in the work you've done over the last 5 years, professionally and personally, and the way you've come alongside other people dealing with their health issues, and the way I've walked alongside a lot of bereaved people over the last 20 years, bereaved through all sorts of means, whether it's death, divorce, diagnosis, workplace change. I think, I mean, certainly in the children's hospice world, when you see parents whose child has just died and you're alongside them, you never, ever see more courage than that. And they're broken down. They think they're never going to breathe again. I mean, I was in that position when my son died. I actually believed I couldn't really breathe anymore in those early minutes and hours. And then gradually you just start to function again, and then you start to live again. And I know you and I have often talked about the power of breath, and we both do a lot of yoga, and, you know, breathing is everything. And obviously it's life itself, isn't it? And I, in those early days after Harry died, I felt I actually viewed that period as being enhanced, because I was so aware of the breath being everything. I wanted to hold on to that feeling in a weird way, because I was so aware that it was really living, even though I'd just witnessed the death of my son. And I've tried to hold on to that in my daily life. But of course, all of us get swept up with email and phone calls and people and needs and wants and a lot of needs that are probably not quite real as well. And I think going back to coronavirus and this discussion, the whole world is resetting at the moment, isn't it? And, you know, I suppose I went through that reset on Harry's diagnosis and then on his death. And you went on a massive reset with your diagnosis. And it's really interesting as to how we hold on to those feelings and use them. And that's what the whole world needs to do right now, isn't it?
I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. I do think it's a reset opportunity. And I remember using those words when the doctor said to me, "Are you angry?" And I said, "No, I'm not angry about my diagnosis. What's the point in being angry? I can't undo it. I think it's just my body telling me this is you're on notice, Nick. You're on notice and you need to reset." And those were the words that I used. I really, really believe that. It doesn't matter about people's particular choice in their spirituality and their faith and or religion. And I think there's a lot of confusion about what all of those words mean. But for me, you know, I've kind of got a lot of strength out of Buddhism. I think there's this whole opportunity to really strip back all this complexity that we've got ourselves into and to understand that we are ultimately people who are biological entities, and there is the whole thing of impermanence, and we're just part of that. Suffering is also part of that. They have this wonderful expression of no mud, no lotus, which is to say that if you don't have the suffering, then you don't get the flower that comes from the suffering. For me, I am seeing so much through the fact that I have been through a diagnosis, which I wouldn't wish on anybody, but 5 years has definitely prepared me for where I am now. In coronavirus. And I am very fortunate in that I am able to see my cancer diagnosis as something positive. And I'm very fortunate to see that I can see corona as something fortunate. And that's, I'm not wishing corona and the consequence of corona on anybody. And there's going to be lots of individual painful consequence. But collectively, as a world, and societies, there's so much that we can benefit from it. Resetting, as you mentioned, businesses truly understanding why are they in existence? And some businesses won't be in existence, but we'll get stripped back to those businesses that truly, truly matter to us as humans.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more, Nick. And going back to what you just said, you know, I, in relation into anybody that finds this recording, by whatever means. I think, you know, I really believe in storytelling, and it's so useful because often when we tell personal stories, it's like holding a mirror up to other people's stories, and hopefully bits of what we're talking about will resonate for other people, whatever their story is. And what I hope is that in listening to what you've just said about your choices of isolation and why you've made them, that other people who may be in full health and are only facing 3 weeks of isolation, or maybe a bit more than that, you know, will listen to what you've just said and your incredible choices and what you've learned over the last 5 years, and realize how very lucky they are. I mean, you and I believe that we're very lucky too. I love your lotus flower quote. The one I love as well is the Gilbran quote, and it's an abridged version of it, that the depth of your sorrow is the height of your joy. And I think, you know, whatever depths we've been to, we saw it last night. Last night was when the whole of the UK stepped out of their houses and clapped for the NHS to celebrate them and to say thank you. And that was a massive example of community spirit coming back into the UK, possibly for the first time since the Second World War on that level. And I think there are so many silver linings, aren't there, which our two quotes demonstrate. How do you structure each day at the moment in your isolation? Do you have any tips that could help people?
I think the structure is really, really important. And when you're in a new environment, I think it's very easy for you to go into that environment and think. So, I thought I'd go into isolation, I'd be able to write a book in the first week. And the second week, I'd be able to read all my library that I hadn't been able to do in the whatever. You know, I thought all this sort of stuff because isolation equals all this abundance of time. But of course, it's not like that at all.
Me too. So
actually, I think you need to fall back on some fundamental life skills, which still apply wherever you are, however you run your life, which is about self-discipline largely. So how I manage myself at the moment is that I start my day with physical activity, you know, to push myself. And, you know, I'm quite physically compromised with my strength at the moment. So, but I mind muscle that through because it's really important. I then do half an hour breathing-based meditation because you talked about breathing. And I mean, it can't be overstressed about how much breathing is, as you say, is just the force for life and is the basis and the home of life. So I do breathing-based meditation, typically guided meditation. Then I do 20 minutes of yoga, which is the yoga that you and I both know, which is a more of a healing, sort of compassionate yoga. So I do 20 minutes of that. And then I do about 10 minutes of really deep belly and chest breathing. By the time I've come out of that, I just feel electrified. And I have to say that if I look at my biological cancer markers, they're going in the wrong direction at the moment quite swiftly. And coupled with that, I got a lot of bone pain and a lot of muscular pain. And I went into this self-imposed isolation and really knuckled down on what I've just said. And my pain has just melted away. It's really, really extraordinary. And I'm not going to tell you the science behind it. There probably isn't. I don't know. But it's just working for me. So that's the first part of my day. And then my breakfast is what I call Bill broth, because I was very fortunate enough to do a bit of filming with Bill Turnbull. And for him, it looked very unappetizing, but it's full of green nutrients, dense foods and whatever else. And then, so 10 o'clock through to 2 o'clock is my earning time, typically. And then 2 o'clock is my lunchtime. And then in the afternoon is very much based around getting out in the garden, looking after my health, being creative, writing, reading. Then at 6 o'clock or prior to 6 is my last food of the day. I will not eat after 6 because there's a form of fasting called time-restricted eating. So I kind of follow that, which means I leave my body 16 hours to think about things other than digesting. And I do that 7 days a week.
That's amazing. It really is. And I think, you know, we can all learn while we're being isolated about that discipline. It's so important, isn't it, to set up some structure to the day. Also, yeah, not to beat yourself up if that slips slightly, but it's good to have it in place. And, you know, I was just like you. I've worked at home as a freelancer for the last 20-odd years. And even when I worked in a children's hospice, I was in the fundraising team, and I did about 2 days a week actually in Oxford, and then 3 days a week working from home. And same with my TV work. And then when I made a film, it was largely from home. So I'm very, very used to that discipline. But I was interested in relation to coronavirus that I've got my two children at home for these weeks, which is just heaven. I'm so lucky. And my partner Jez is here too. And we're all working from home, and it's all going really well. And I thought I was going to be the one that nailed this, that because I'm so used to working from home. And actually, out of all of us, I've probably been the one that has been the most dislodged slightly by everybody being here, but also just purely because I realized that I was a lot more unsettled by coronavirus and what it means. You know, maybe because I've already had one child die, I was a lot more scared than I realized of this. And, you know, so often I think with grief and in facing challenges, any major life changes, I think I thought I'd got it nailed because of what I've already been through. And actually, I've discovered that I didn't, you know, and it's taken me a few days to really adjust to this and to allow myself to some space to think to think with some sadness, to think about the changes that are going on, to allow myself the depth of sorrow, and then to come through that and look for the silver linings and to get my head round it. And actually, it was you and I talking yesterday and admitting that we were feeling vulnerable about all of this and that we were finding it hard to work and hard to concentrate and hard to make that structure that inspired this conversation, wasn't it? Because we admitted our vulnerability to each other and that we weren't actually writing our books and doing all the amazing things that we'd set ourselves to do. And actually, you and I have wanted to do this conversation on recording of some sort. We were originally going to do it on stage, weren't we? Which was how we first met. Yeah. And, you know, it was that conversation yesterday where we admitted vulnerability and then we both got completely inspired. I had an amazing day yesterday where quite a lot of work came in from companies because I think my energy and my emails to them was completely different having spoken to you. And it was amazing. And then today we decided we would do this recording. So in winding it up, I hope that what we've discussed, I hope people can be inspired by it, certainly by your story, Nick, and what you've chosen to do and how you're living your life in isolation for now with all your physical challenges and mental challenges in dealing with it. And I hope that both our stories will resonate a bit for people and that when they're in isolation, maybe there are a few things that we've been able to help them with. That's really... What are your views? What would you like people to take away from this?
My takeaway is, although we talked about this sort of great enabler that is self-discipline, you know, a lot of people say, oh my God, you know, I'm the first person to lie to myself and I beat myself up about it, is that we must not do that. We must foremostly be really just be human about it. We're not machines. So this whole thing about vulnerability and just admitting that you're feeling vulnerable about something and talking about that to your loved ones is just so, so, so important. We've got this unique opportunity of sharing. I mean, how weird is it that you kind of got this juxtaposition, which is brought on us by COVID, that says you've got to socially isolate and yet we kind of somehow feel more together. There's kind of more community that's coming to it. It's very strange, this thing. But through it, I'm stripping away all the complex bits and I'm discovering just those smaller and smaller, more simple things that I am not giving, I hadn't given credit to in my previous life, that I'm actually now recognizing and they're coming to the fore, like my wonderful family, my wonderful friends, nature, and actually the joy of a new day starting. And, you know, we've just got to reinvent our lives and really cherish them and live in the moment and really enjoy that.
Thank you, Nick. That's fantastic.
Well, thank you, Lizzie. It's been really brilliant to talk to you too. Awesome. Stay safe.